Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here tonight. We've got three sets of notes. We're not going to read through them word for word, but I want to have them to refer to. We got one set, which is a main set of notes called Dates of the Bible. Then we're going to have one that's got several artifacts in it called Adam and Eve, beginning with Adam and Eve seal. This is kind of explaining the images I've got on this new map that we've got set up here, or a timeline that we've got set up there, just for your information, so you kind of know what's up here, because it's kind of hard to tell. And then there's going to be the Kirk Stella, which is this image right here, which comes from 853, that has several bits of information on it, but one of the main things it mentions King Ahab of Israel, and we're going to refer to that. Now, what we're doing is we spent last week going over some explanations on why scientifically, not just, you know, because the Bible says so, but scientifically the earth could be a young earth with the ideal of science and the light and all the things that they're discovering, the deterioration of, like we talked about, the DNA, the magnetic field, the buildup on the sea of the soot, the salt, or the silt and the salt. Again, not going to go into that. I'm not a scientist, but finally, after living through the 60s and 70s and even the 80s of, you know, you got to go with the Big Bang. If you don't agree with evolution, you're stupid. It's really kind of boomeranging around. There's a snowball effect taking place scientifically. There's people that are going to resist it, but there's a revolution taking place within science where, wait a minute, we've misjudged some things. Nothing wrong with that. Same thing. If you make a mistake in teaching the Bible, you come back, you make a correction. You got to start somewhere. But we're not alone, so we have a lot more room. It's going to reflect in my teaching. For example, I'm presenting to you right here the young earth dates. I'm going to show you the dates. Now, if nothing else is going to be entertaining, well, who knows if it's entertaining. It's a Bible class looking at dates. Sounds a lot like history class, but more boring. But there's a justification for this. I'm going to show you how we can get to a certain date of a young earth. It's going to be interesting. We'll cover a lot of ground. I've never, even all my years, when I was a young kid, I was all about dinosaurs and evolution. And you know, I was 6, 8, 10 years old. But then became a Christian, I accepted the scriptures and really didn't know what to do with it. Just believed God created the world. I know I went to college, and in a class there, they were teaching basically theistic evolution in a Sunday school class for college kids, and how every day represented billions of years. And I rejected that right away because I didn't like it, because it's not what the Bible says. And I got in trouble because I had to write a report for a class, and I was critical, and I got a D on it. They chewed me out. I mean, on the paper, they didn't grade my paper. They ripped me for being arrogant that I wasn't listening to the teachers. And I never really bought into theistic evolution, but I did hold to, how could you not, coming out of the 60s, 70s, that the earth is old, billions of years old. I mean, it's just all around you. Everybody's telling you that. And so I taught it, and I thought it was clever. I thought it worked, and thought maybe, you know, it was hidden there in the Bible. The gap theory. It's in the framework book. The gap theory, that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This was billions of years ago, and the earth just kind of stayed there and developed, you know, like stew. And it began to evolve, and all the planets were put in place for all the natural controlled process that God was doing. And that would include Satan's rebellion, the fall of the angels. And then God made man, and then in 7 days, he reformed the earth for man in 7 days. So not a lot of work. It's like remodeling a house instead of building a house from ground up. And I taught that. I wasn't like sold out to it, betting my salvation on it, but I was like, hey, if that's what this is saying. Now, I you can just see where I'm at, again, and not that I'm right today. But I've got enough confidence now where, no, I disagree with the gap theory. I disagree with theistic evolution. I disagree with evolution. I believe God, in some time early in the past, I've got the date right there, 4,141 B.C. Now, that's my own number. Don't think, well, where'd you get that? Well, I figure that out. And I'm going to show you some other options. Don't write that down and say that's just, I'm going to show you how I got that number. And I think we're close to a 4,000-year or a 6,000-year-old Earth. And again, we've got science on our side. I was going to show you some things about tonight about the ape men that have been discovered and they're in the museums and how they're been all, you know, they're fake, they're false. They've got pieces, and then they with their theory, this is what it should look like, and we've got these two pieces. Well, those two pieces must be these two, and then we let the theory fill everything else in. And that is like through museum after museum. And again, and what Kay was handing out, it's that group of people, the creation scientists, and they're not like, you know, Baptist preachers in the down south in the backwoods somewhere, rant and raving. They're scientists with degrees. Some of them are, in a sense, stealth or undercover. Some of them have lost their careers or had a switch because they won't put up with it in the academic. Just imagine, you know, in a situation, maybe you've got like certain values, like conservative values, and then some institution comes against you. I don't know if you can imagine anything like that happening in America today. Maybe like the media, Hollywood, entertainment, education. It happens everywhere. And so they've got some ideas there that, and the guy's gone around, and I've got a video coming, and I've got a book about it, where they've gone through and they've examined these, and there's no missing links from humans. There's species that God has created, and fossils have been discovered, and they try to say, well, this could be, and it ends up not being what they want it to be. And so and you can do your own research, they'll talk a big talk, but there's nothing there. And you can see people feeding you false information. Just watch the media telling you what's not happening. It's like, this is what's happening in America. It's like, no, it's not, because I live here in America, and that's not what's happening. And they tell this to you as it's a lie. Now, Bible teachers can do the same thing. We've all been lied to or misled by Bible teachers. I've made mistakes myself. Now, with that being said, I lay the foundation right here. This is where I'm at, is I'm going to present to you, as we read through Genesis, the young earth. Now, the Bible story is the same. It's just fun to put these dates on, I think. So maybe, and I've used this before, it's maybe reckless. Maybe it's reckless to do this. Now, if you're a pastor of a mega church and you've got a staff of 120 people depending on you putting butts in the pews, you better not be putting this up in your charts on your overhead projector, because you're going to empty the pews quick. So again, the mega churches aren't going to be able to embrace this kind of teaching. But here in my little group here with this, you know, my 10 people that watch online, you know, they'll just forward fast or come back another day or go somewhere else. That's happened before, too. Nonetheless, first thing we've got on this, the pictures right here, I should show you this. And this, again, I hope this helps. When you look at Genesis chapter 1 through 10 up to 11, this is the way it's written, the way it's going to work for us, is you're going to have, think of Google Earth, you're looking from the top down, you see the big, you know, planet, and then you zoom into your street level, and you've all done it, you've all zoomed in and looked at your house, gone to the street level and looked at, you know, who was walking by your house when they went by with the Google cameras. That's what this is right here. This is the big view, creation order, chapter 1 up through chapter 2, verse 4. This is what takes place, the 7 days, and how it all took place. Then we zoom in on the same fact, the same plot, but we zoom in on the garden. And we get some details of the creation. The man is there. The mist coming from the earth is there. The garden. Now, it doesn't say, and it's not talking about everything on the earth. It's zoomed in on this one place in the created order. I mean, you got the whole universe, and then they zoom in on the man, the mist, the garden, the tree, and the four rivers. And that's what this is about, then, the rest of chapter 2, telling you that. Then it continues to give you the story of the fall, going to the story of Cain and Abel, and then we repeat this right here two more times. It's going to give you the big picture, you know, the satellite view or the of genealogy from Adam to Noah. And then from there, what happens during this time period? Well, we're going to have Genesis 6. the sons of God, the fallen ones, the powerful ones, they perform an act, and then they continue to do that during this time period, and there's some problems. Then there's going to be, Noah is going to be told to build the ark, then the flood's going to come, and then after the flood, you've got the story of Ham and Canaan are taking place right here. That is taking place between Adam and Noah, the zoomed-in look on what's taking place. After this, we go back to the genealogy, Genesis chapter 10, the Japheth, Ham, and Shem, the three sons of Noah are introduced, kind of in a general sense. Here's Japheth, and not much time is spent on Japheth. They go away, and there's not much interaction because this book is heading towards Israel. It's heading towards Abraham. It's heading towards the chosen people. Japheth is mentioned a little bit there, and he's gone. Ham is mentioned. He's going to end up interacting with the line of Abraham. But what's interesting here is a story pops up here. Ham has a son named Cush, which you're going to want to remember, who has a son named Nimrod, who becomes the first actual world conqueror. And we'll spend some time looking at maps and going through where the Bible talks about where he moved from, right where the Tower of Babel was at. He moved from there and conquered. And his name is Nimrod in the Bible. And there's a volume of reasons to believe Nimrod is Sargon the First. Because same city, same location, moving the same way, conquering the same. It's the first conqueror that takes place. So that's Sargon. That could be Nimrod. Okay? Again, the Bible doesn't call him Sargon, but Moses is writing at in his lifetime, putting these things together, gathering information, and he's recounting what takes place from Ham's line through Cush up through Nimrod. Now, then Shem, Eber, and the word Eber is also Heber, which is in the language of the Assyrians and the Israelites, is the Hebrew. And that is the word Hebrew in the ancient writings in the text. So Eber is Heber, which is in their language, Hebrew. And they're going to be a group of people that when, right during Joshua's invasion of the Promised Land, Armana letters, that the cuneiform writing that they're sending up to Egypt, or sending down to Egypt, the Canaanites crying out for help because they're being invaded by the Hebrew. And it's the Hebrews. And for years, that doesn't say Hebrew. That doesn't say Hebrew. And yet, it does. It's the word Hebrew. They're being invaded by the Hebrew. Anyway, that picks up right there. And Abraham is called Abraham the Hebrew. He has a son named Peleg, or eventually Peleg, and then on down, and not that direct like this. During this time, that's just mentioned right there. Then we're going to get the story of the Babel that takes place here. Then they're going to get a detail, genealogy of Shem, all the way to Abram, because that's what the story's about. Abram's here, and here's some pictures that we've got here. Now, some of these are directly connected to the Bible. Some of them, now, the Christians are under pressure. I got to check my microphone here because it started scratchy. I couldn't even use the recording last week because it was so scratchy. We're under pressure because as they do excavation work, you go to the British Museum and they've got all these. Well, here, I took this picture of the British Museum, the cuneiform writing of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Right in here, it talks about a worldwide flood. There's so many things in the writing that it's like, the gods came down and confused the languages or gave man different languages. The gods came down and sent a flood, or the gods came down and it's like, whoa, Moses, all he's doing is just copying the Assyrian story. Now just imagine an event. Let's imagine Iran sending 500 drones over Israel, and then imagine the story that came about. First of all, you could be in the position of, well, from the divine point, and then God protected Israel. Iran attacked. God, drew these people together, protected it, and got the biblical account. Or you could go back and you could have the pagan account of, the the weapon systems defended it, or Iran's talking. It was a political victory, and it's got everybody's telling the same story, but they're telling it from their perspective. Now, that doesn't mean Israel telling the story is copying the Iranian story about the event, or that the media in the West is copying the media in the East. It's like this happened, and then everybody's got to talk about what happened. And there's going to be a fall. There's going to be a flood. There's going to be a Tower of Babel. There's going to be these events, and it's going to happen, in a sense, to everybody. And now, just imagine, without being critical, how far off some churches are today. And they could have gone off in the 1800s. They could have gone off in the 1960s. They could go off on some tangent today. But they're talking about the Bible, Jesus Christ, the Creator, who redeemed us from sin. And now, 2,000 years later, let's hear your take on it. It's like, no, it's not about social action. Yes, no, it's not about just being kind to each other. Nice try. Yes, no, it's not just about getting baptized and not drinking beer. It's like, no, there's. It's like, what are we talking about? And so you're going to get different accounts. Who's right? Well, this happened. But everyone, even if you have the truth, by the time you tell the story, look at the church, how far off you're going to go as people tell the story. So some of these things, for example, this, the first thing, I'm not going to read this to you. I'll just say what it is. This is known as the Adam and Eve cylinder or seal. It's a little cylinder, it's about an inch big, and you'd roll it in clay. Here's the seal. It's a lot bigger here. It's only about this big. I've got some Sumerian seals I've got at home. And then you roll it out, and this is the impression right here. And the impression is there's a tree in the middle. You can see it on this first page. There's a tree here in the middle with fruit hanging on it. Here's a woman sitting here. There's a man sitting here. And there's a serpent right behind him talking to him. Now, some would say, and they call it the Adam and Eve seal. It's in the British Museum. There it is. And it's something about fruit, a tree, a man and a woman with this serpent around them. Now, that doesn't mean that was Adam's seal that he wrote his name with, but it does mean that somewhere around 2100 BC is when this is dated, which would come in right about the time of Abraham right here. That's when they date this. Now, my dates, I'm getting, these people are getting dates for some other way, some other reason. Sometimes they're right. Egyptian dating is completely goofed up. Even the Egyptianologists, it's like there's early date, late date, they're still discussing Egyptian dating. And so we can't think, well, the pyramids are, 10,000, 12,000 years old. It's like, no, they've got in the stone, the limestones that they cut and built the pyramids out of, there's their limestone from sediment that is settled with sea fossils in it. The stones came from after the flood, having chipped up the sediment that became rock and put them in pyramids. So the pyramids were built, a good guess is, right here, during the time of Abraham, is when the pyramids were constructed. And again, well, it's like, date them how you want to, but all that, all those, imagine your politicians, your university professors, who are all under the influence of evolution, materialism, naturalism, and that there is no God, and now they're going to prescribe for you medicine. They're going to prescribe for you a good education. They're going to run your government. They're going to do all of these. They're going to make all your decisions. And now they're exploring, and they're working with a billion years old Earth, and people have been around for at least the last, I don't even know how long they're going to say. And so they've got all kinds of room to work with. If you put them on this scale, all of a sudden the things start crunching. It's like, well, that would work, but we're working with, it's like playing a football game. Where's the end zone? Way over there in California. Now, I'm pointing the wrong way probably. It's like, well, just start running, and then we'll chase you. It's like, what? How do I know I scored? It's like, well, now if you put it actually on the game, you put it on a 100-yard field, now the game changes. We can still play the game. You don't need to play it all over the United States. Now, that's a bad example. These are cuneiform tablets. I took that picture in the British Museum. I took this picture in the British Museum. Let's see if what happens on the next page. I don't even have it on here. This is the Gilgamesh. That talks about the flood. And there's several accounts of the flood. Even Ashurbanipal is going to come after. Well, we talk about him during the days of the minor prophets. Ashurbanipal, he said he was educated and he could read the cuneiform writings of the scribes. He could even read in his own writing. He said, I can read the writings, the tablets from before the flood, which indicates he believed there had been a flood and everything had been wiped out. But the tablets were put on the ark and brought back out, and he could go, and they had access to these documents, meaning Moses had access to documents. And one of the Assyrian kings, Ashurbanipal, said, I can read the writings that were written before the flood. So they thought there was a flood. So there's that story. This is amazing right here. Let's see what's coming up next, see if I can do this in order. Okay, let's do this one. This is the page 2, the still of the vultures. This right here, you can see there's a picture of it, and there's a close-up of it right there. This talks about the gods confusing the languages coming down. It's a Sumerian, and it refers to how the gods of the sweet water came down and mixed up the languages. Okay, the next one here, now that's a drawing of it there. This one is amazing right here, and I'm going to spend time on this when we get to Cush right here. Because Cush comes from a town in southern Mesopotamia, and the town he comes from where he produces Nimrod, his son, is the same city that this comes from. And right here is written, and I got it. Yeah, I've got it right there at the bottom of page 4. This says Cush right here. It's this Kish, Cush, Kishim, Cushim. It's all the same, you know, the way you pronounce it with the K, the U, the I. That is his name right there. There's 17 different writings, tablets with his name on it from this location, from this city, which is the same time period that this Cush, according to this chart, was on the earth in that city. And he would be, again, Ham, Cush, Nimrod. We're talking about, you know, the grandson of Noah. And, of course, he's going to be a powerful individual. And this is a bit about here. He's talking about getting, he's buying barley for beer, either producing beer. And that's what that's talking about. And so there's some details with that. What else we got? This is a picture of Sargon there. I got a picture of Sargon standing in front of the Tree of Life down here. These are some images I took pictures of in the Oriental Institute in Chicago, at the University of Chicago. They've changed the name because it was offensive recently. I don't know what they called it, but they thought it was too offensive because it referred to people. But nonetheless, these are statues from the time of Abraham, from the area of Ur and around the Mesopotamian area. These would be from 2900, 2600 B.C. They would have they look not real good right now because they're 3,000-4,000 years old, but they would have been colored. They would have had stones in their eyes, sockets, you know, so they looked like they'd be very beautiful. And what they would do, they'd be in their gods, to the temple, if I wanted to make sure I would please my God, I'd have an artist, a craftsman, make an image of me in prayer with my eye. Eyes are always real wide because you're receptive and understanding and ready to receive from the Lord or from the God. And then you'd stand that there in the temple. You'd pay to have it stood in this temple, and then you could go do stuff because your God would be like, oh, there's Galen. Well, look, Galen, still here worshiping. Where's Galen? Look, he's still here praying. It's like their gods are a little bit, I don't know, slower than our God, Yahweh, because they could put an image of themselves in there, and he would still bless them because, oh, look, he's still in my presence or whatever, something like that. That's what these are all for. They're all religious purposes. Okay. That's that. We're done with that part right there. Now, let's get started. And this other one with the Kirk Stella, I'm going to come back to that in a moment. It's right here. I could pass that around here. But we're going to go to the page 1 that says dates of the Bible. Now, first of all, I apologize for putting dates on a chart, okay? I apologize. Am I right? I would guess I'm not right. What I'm shooting for is about 4,000 years old, that the earth is about 6,000 years old, that Adam was created, the earth was created about 4,000 B.C. Maybe it's 5,000, maybe, you know, some give and take. Is it 4141 B.C.? No, in fact, after I go through this tonight, I think I'm going to go home and review it, and I think I've already got an adjustment to make. I made a mistake. Now, you'll see how easy it to make a mistake is when you look at this. But is it the Big Bang evolution, or is it 4141 B.C.? It's 4141 B.C. It's not evolution. Okay, that's what I'm saying. Now, here we go. James Ussher, Archbishop of the Church of Ireland. You all know him somehow. You've come across his material. 1500 to 1600. I was talking to Steve last night. We couldn't remember when he lived. But he's Archbishop of the Church of Ireland. He dated creation, and he was a brilliant scholar. Brilliant scholar from the 1500s, 1600s, 4004 B.C. I remember Bibles, King James Bibles, study Bibles, King James study Bibles that were from early 1900s, 1800s, they have his chart in there. It's like, in fact, you have Bibles somewhere from your grandparents that have Genesis chapter 1, and it's dated in the margin, 4004 B.C. I mean, it's there. He even worked into, I think it's October 6th or something. And it wasn't just a random, he's doing the math and he's figuring out the Jewish holidays. Anyway, that's his date. I give God a little more time. The Hebrew calendar, since the 300s A.D., they set creation at 3761 B.C. So if you go to a Hebrew calendar or Hebrew school today, they will teach you 3761 B.C., God created the world. And that's what they came up with, and they're scholars. Now, these are not shop teachers teaching a Bible study in the basement somewhere like you have. These guys are the best Jewish scholars in 300 A.D., or the best of the Irish European scholars in the 1500s. The early Syrian Christians dated creation at 5490 B.C. That would be the Syrian Christians. That's the Church of Antioch, where Paul and Peter were in the book of Galatians and in the book of Acts. The Eastern Greek Orthodox Church, beginning in the 600s, dated creation to 5508 B.C., and that's the Greek Orthodox Church that covers all of Turkey, all of Ukraine, all the way up into Russia. In fact, up until the 1800s, it was official Russian information. Whoever the empire was there in Russia, that was the government. Then in the 1800s, they're like, they backed off of it in the 1800s. So understand, you're living in a window of time. We think we're cool. We think the world is all about us. But we're living in the spec. If the earth is, 10,000 years old, these people, these people all believe that there was a creation. There's creation legends in the Assyrian material. They all believe that they were created. The Greeks, the Romans, everybody believed. You can go through the Incas. You can go through all the different cultures, and there's some kind of creation. Then when Christianity came, Islam, a creator. Christianity, all across the world, wherever Christianity, there is a creator and a creation. And it wasn't until the 1800s that it was suggested that it was a long, long time. And then it was the 1900s, especially with the monkey trial in the 1920s, 1930s, and it got into the textbooks where evolution became the standard and it became scientific. And if you went to college, you were educated. And now, if you don't go to college and you don't buy into this, you're stupid, uneducated, because we all know this. You're talking about a period of 100 years. I mean, it's 2024. Go back to 1924, and you're in the midst of the monkey trial. You're in the midst of the world, the United States, saying, we're not having this, and we're not going to teach this in our schools. And then they look like fools because they weren't scientifically ready for it. The person, and I write about it in Hope for Mary's Last Generation, the person presenting the argument for the Christians was an arrogant politician that did a pathetic job and just looked like a fool, and all of a sudden it flipped, and we lost traction. And for the last 100 years, you've been inundated with the idea that the earth is old, and a chart like this is reckless and foolish, except for the fact that they did this, Ussher. The Jews, the Hebrews, the Syrians, the Greek Orthodox Church, including Russia, all had this until the 1800s. The Hebrews still do. Answers in Genesis, which is a great ministry. I got this chart from their site right there. They still use 404 B.C. to work with as a rough number. Now, again, are they going to bet their salvation on it? No. Are they going to call you a heretic if you say, I don't know, maybe it's 4141 B.C.? They may say you need to look into it because that's Galen's number. But they're not going to bet their Christianity on this number. Notice right there, I've got dates, not I've got, but I've got their dates right there for all of these events. And I'm about to show you, I hope. Okay. Now, we begin. Does that make sense? Anybody got a question or anything? Yeah, because if you do, you're going to railroad the whole class. Don't ask a question, because otherwise I'll answer it, and then we'll be back next week picking up right here. But that's not your fault. That's me as a poor teacher. We begin this adventure in the year 853 B.C., right here, 853 B.C., because if we're going to date, I'm going to show you how to get here. I'm going to show you how I got here, how Usher got here, how the Hebrews get here, how the Greek Orthodox, how the whole world, how the Christian world got here. Now, again, you can give and take and reinterpret things a different way, but this is not just a reckless idea. This is a biblical, scriptural approach. Now, if you're reading it literally, say, well, if you want to say, well, this is all metaphors and allegories, well, then you can't date it. I mean, you can't date it. I mean, you're just guessing. But I'm going to read it literally. Here it is. In 1853, with the Battle of Kokar, and I'll show you the place where this is all taking place here, the Assyrian king Shalmaneser III comes from the east, coming over from Mesopotamia, Babylon, Assyria, coming to the west, coming up into Syria, Aram, into that area, north of Israel. He's coming, and he faces an alliance of western kings. There's like 10, 11, 12 western kings. When I say western kings, we're talking about west of the Euphrates. We're talking about the Arameans. We've read about this. This is the book of Hosea, Jonah. This is happening during these guys' time. The kings from the west then meet them, and Shalmaneser describes his battles in chronological order on the Kirk Stella. The Kirk Stella is right here. If you turn the page, you want to see. Oh, that's this. Here, that's this whole packet right here. Got a whole packet. I took this picture right here. Kirk Stella, I took that picture. Here's one with the other kings right there. That's me standing beside it right there on the back page. That's a different one, but right beside it in the British Museum, because these kings would always put up stelas and engrave on there all of their career. It was like their media. This is like the CNN of Shalmaneser, Ashurbanipal, right here. This is the best they could do and got their promotion. So, again, sometimes their numbers are inflated, you know, you think possibly. But when they start putting names of kings that they're defeating, and they're the names of kings in the Bible, you're like, this is, again, I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm saying it's propaganda. But there has to be some battle that took place, and they had to defeat some king. And one of the kings they defeat or face was Ahab. Now, this image right here, I've got all the details here on the top here. You can see the images right here. There's four images. There's a winged disc, a symbol of their god Ashur, a six-pointed star, which represents Ashtar. There's a crown of the sky god Anu with three horns. And there's a disc and a crescent of the god Sin, S-I-N. Not doesn't mean sin. Do not sin any longer. It's just his name, Sin. Those are the symbols right here. And he's reaching up with his finger out right here, which is an indication that he's, well, third point down there, Shalmaneser III's motion with his right hand to indicate one of the following, a motion indicating urban damaku tarusa, which translates to scratch out a favorable finger, or to stretch out a favorable finger. It's like he's blessing you. The opposite of a finger being extended is this right here, a fist. So this is obviously, you know, you could get in traffic and add fingers to it if you wanted to. But this is the finger of blessing. This is no finger, which means I'm coming to hurt you or I'm sending you a curse. And so he's apparently sending out a blessing, or these other options, the end of the action of throwing a kiss, like an act of worship, like taking a kiss and throwing the kiss to the gods that he's looking at up here, and he's honoring the gods. Again, very, very, you know, you want to say superstitious. They're trying to make the gods happy because all their success comes from getting favor from the gods. As a result of cracking, could be like snapping his fingers as a ritual act. Greeks talk about that. Being a simple gesture of authority. But anyway, that's all taking place on there, on that stela. On the next page right here, I took a picture of the little plaque that they've got right beside it. So this is what it says on the plaque in the British Museum. It says right there, it's limestone, gives the date. It's concludes with the Battle of Kakar in 853 B.C. So this ends, the last battle he has is 853 B.C. when they're sent home and he wins. He defeated the king of Damascus. And again, on there, in bold print to the left of that, showing up with apparently 10,000 foot soldiers and 2,000 chariots. That's what some people wonder. Ahab shows up with 2,000 chariots and 10,000 foot soldiers. That seems like a large number, some scholars say. But again, this is propaganda saying, you know, it's like, and I beat back Ahab. He had two chariots and 10 soldiers. It's like, wait a minute. He had 2,000 chariots, 10,000 soldiers. That may be happening. It's not a biblical issue. But what it is, the biblical issue is, he did face Ahab and identifies him as Ahabu Sir-Ila'ah, which is Ahab of Israel. So he faced, on this right here, on this stela, Shalmaneser III says he faced Ahab of Israel. And that means Ahab of Israel was there in 853 fighting that battle. The next thing down, we don't have much time to do all this. This happens next because I'll show you in the notes here. Ahab goes to Ramoth-Gilead across the Jordan River to fight a battle, and it was prophesied by Elijah that he was going to die. Goes over there, gets killed, and dies, and is brought back and is buried. That happens right after this battle is the Ramoth-Gilead. So Ahab dies in 853. His sons become king. One son becomes king for 2 years. Another son follows that. This is during Elisha, during his ministry. At that time, in Moab, right across from the Dead Sea, on the east side, it's where Jordan is today, they have been under his Ahab. Omri is Ahab's father, and Ahab, they've been under their control, paying taxes or tribute to northern Israel. But once Omri's dead and Ahab has finally died, and he was powerful, when his sons take over, the Moabites decide, hey, here's a good time to rebel. And they say, you know, we're not paying our tribute, and got ready for war. That's when Israel joins with Judah and goes to war. And that's another whole story. But Moab ends up driving Israel and Judah back, and they set up the Mesha Stele, or the Moabite stone. It's set up in Dibon, Jordan. I'll show you a map of it. And on that, it says these things. It's out of 2 Kings 3, 5 through 6. The whole account is in 2 Kings chapter 3. It says in the scriptures, when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Jehoram marched out of Samaria at that time and mustered all of Israel. That's what the scripture says. They got a whole account of it. You know the story. That's where Elijah digs the trenches. And then Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, somehow they sacrifice one of the king's sons on the wall of the city in Moab and just repulses everybody. It's a weird story. Nonetheless, on this stela he sets up, you can see the lines are numbered. One, I am Mesha, son of Chemosh, the king of Moab, the Dibeonite. And it goes through each line. And notice in line 4, it mentions Omri. That's Omri's the father of Ahab, who's the father of the king, or Omri's grandson's the one that got defeated. He mentions king of Israel. Turn the page. I skip a few lines. I didn't write the whole thing. The whole thing's written out in the framework book. Line 7, he mentions Israel. Watch this. Listen, this is fun. This is a lot of fun. Line 7 on page 3. He writes on that stela there in Dibon, in Moab, he writes, Israel has perished. It has perished forever. Okay, that was 853 B.C., and it's the same thing Egypt wrote on one of theirs, that Israel is no longer a people. Well, it's just kind of, that should be funny. You should have laughed at that part. Okay, never mind. Omri is mentioned again, verse 18, or line 18, he took the vessels of Yahweh, and I presented them before the face of Chemosh, and the king of Israel had built. And he mentions a city. And also in line 31, he mentions the house of David. So you've got a name of a king, you've got the name of Israel, you've got the house of David, you've got Yahweh on that stela. Right? And then on that back page, that's me standing in front of another one of the Assyrians. We'll look at that one later as we get there. Okay, the dates of the Bible. So that's where we start with, dating 853, with Ahab is still alive fighting Salmaneser, but then his son takes over, and within a year or 2 years, his second son, that's the king, is fighting the Moabites who have rebelled because Ahab is dead. So we're putting Ahab's death, and this is not me, this is people that are looking for this. Ahab dies in 853. Okay, and now we start the process. Are you ready for this? Now you turn to page 2. Here's some background information for you. Page 2, there's the two maps I should have showed you earlier. The first map is 1 Kings 22, when Ahab goes over to fight the Arameans at Ramoth-Gilead. The reason he's fighting is because that is the entrance to the trade route that runs through the Jezreel Valley. And so if he can get control of Ramoth-Gilead, he's got the trade, the north and south trade that goes up and down through Ramoth-Gilead, and the trade that breaks off and goes west down through Israel and then picks up the coastal plain. That's like the headquarters of the trading industry. He goes to fight to get that back from the Arameans and is killed, just like it was prophesied. So Rahab dies there. His son becomes king, and then the second map there, 2 Kings verse 3 is the Moabite rebellion. And you can see Joram comes down. Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, joins him. And they come down there and they're going to fight. And Elijah digs we're out of water. Why has God brought us here? And they kind of tune Elijah out. Why did God lead us in a battle and then we're going to die of thirst? He says, bring me a musician. They start playing music. And then he receives a word from the Lord and says, start digging trenches. What? Start digging trenches. And they start digging trenches, and water fills up in the trenches. And there's a whole battle. Then the sun comes up, it reflects on the trenches of water, and the Moabites think, oh my gosh, we're going to be defeated. That he kills his son on the wall, apparently as a human sacrifice to Chemosh. And everybody's like, this is stupid or something. I don't know what happens. I mean, you read the story, it's like, what? And they're all repulsed, and they all went home. And then he sets up in the Moabite stone that I just talked about. He sets it up at Dibon, right there, and that's where they found it. Now again, sad story about this. I don't want to go into this, but they found it buried. And two different groups of people in the 1800s were trying to buy it. They just discovered it, and one group offered money, another group said, "We'll give you a lot more money." And they thought the Arabs, so hey. This is worth some money. So they dug it half. It was already halfway dug up by the archaeologists. So they put a bunch of wood around it, lit the wood on fire, and got it so hot that it cracked into like a lot of little pieces. See, there's cracks all over it. And then they gave each Arab took a little bit home. And so you want this? We're all going to make money. And it's like, and so they went around and they bought as much as they could find, but of course crumbs were falling off, and then they reassembled it, and that is the Moabite stone. I want to cry as I hear that. It's like, I know that's not the most terrible thing that could happen in life, but it's like, what? It's like, wouldn't we like to have the whole content of that? And how many things like that have happened? Okay, nonetheless. Gosh. Do I have it written down here? Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, it's big. Yeah, it's like 4 foot by 3 foot or something like that. Yeah. You can see that one picture that I'm standing by, that one. Yeah. Yeah, that's why it was buried, and they're going to have to get some kind of machinery to lift it out. And that's why they couldn't get it out, so they just burned it up and took little pieces of it. Does it say it right there?
Yeah.
The Moabite. I thought I wrote it down somewhere. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to shoot through a bunch of numbers now, and I would like to show you the verses. I'll show you a few of them. Start in 1 Kings, if you would, go to 1 Kings chapter 16. 1 Kings chapter 16. We would be here for a long time. 1 Kings 16, verse 29. And the year Ahab dies is 853. But it will tell you Ahab, his first year, and how long he reigned. And 1 Kings 16:29, where am I at here? In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab's son Omri became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord. So there we have the dating of his beginning. And he's going to end up ruling. It goes on down here. We're going to be going backwards. 1 Kings 16:23. In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king of Israel, and he reigned 12 years. So that's Omri reigning 12 years. And now what you start doing is every time you do this, you find that line of Israel kings. You could do it with Judah too. We're going to pick them up in a minute. And you just keep adding 12 years. It says they reigned for 12 years. So Omri, we added 12 years. So that's 882. Omri becomes king in 882. You can go through there. Zimri is going to reign. He becomes king in 886. The son of Baasha, 887. Baasha's first year is 909 B.C., and that is Judah's king Asa's third year in 1 Kings 15. Then I'm on page 3 right now. As you subtract it, now we're into 1 Kings 15:25. Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel. Remember, Jeroboam is the one who rebelled against Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and started the northern kingdom. He's the one who set up the golden calves in the Bethel and Dan. Well, his son became king in Israel in the second year of Asa, and he reigned over Israel for 2 years. So Nadab is going to rule and reign. But then in 912, Jeroboam, that's his 20th year on my notes. That's Asa's first year. Asa's first year, the king of Judah, is 1 Kings 15:9. And Jeroboam's first year of reign is 931. I just keep doing the math here, and you can double-check this. Anybody can do it. Jeroboam's first year is 931, if you add that up, because he's going to rule, 1 Kings 14:21. You'll have charts in your Bibles. Sort of the same thing. Rehoboam, 1 Kings 14:21. Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king in Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years. So if you can get down there to 931, you see, and that's Jeroboam's first year, well, you know, we can read it, and it's written down there in 1 Kings 11, how many years did Solomon rule? 40. And so you add 40, Solomon became king right there. 971 is Solomon's first year as king. So that means that's the year David died, is 971 B.C. Now you see, I haven't done anything spiritual or interpretative except read the numbers and do the math. It's like all I did is say, this is history, and I'm just doing the math. That's why it's like, well, how do you know? It's like, well, if you believe the Bible, this is what it says. Now you're going to have to come up with a good excuse why you are not going to believe it. But nonetheless, an important verse is going to be in 1 Kings 6. Go to 1 Kings 6. This is one of the big verses. Because in 1 Kings 6, Solomon now is ruling, and he is building the temple. And chapter 6, now we know when Solomon, we're basing it on 583 from Ahab. We've just counted back through the kings, Israel's kings, Judah's kings, and now we're at Solomon. His last year was 931. His first year as king was 971 B.C., based on what we've looked at very quickly. Okay, chapter 6, verse 1 of 1 Kings. In the 480th year after the Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. Now, I don't know, that sounds a lot like maybe a myth or poetry or maybe just a metaphor for something. Or does it sound like they're giving you the exact day of the month of the year of the fourth year of his reign, 5 years after David died, or 4 years if you count that way, Solomon began to build the temple. And that would mean right there, that's why I can write down there, sometime, again, their 12-month year does not always line up with our 12-month year, but that would be 967, 966 B.C., Solomon begins building the temple. But what's the key word, phrase in there? that is the year. It's 480 years after Israel came out of Egypt. When Moses led Israel out of Egypt, it was 480 years before 966. So you do that. Look right there. I add 480 to the number and I get right there. 1446 B.C., Moses leads the Exodus. Where'd you get that number? Well, I showed you. We started in a solid date right here. And again, if it's not solid, we're within 2 years. 853, and we worked our way back through Scripture. Solomon's building the temple at 480 years. You're in 1446. That's when the Exodus takes place. And that means they're in the wilderness for 40 years. That means Joshua came across the Jordan and fought Jericho, or marched around Jericho in 1406 B.C. Well, I'm not sure where your theology is getting it. I'm not using theology. I'm using it's called math, and a second grader can do it. Well, maybe a second grader in the 1960s. I'm not sure about a second grader today. Okay. Then there's another important verse. Go to Exodus chapter 12. Are you with me on this? Again, you don't have to agree with me. Or if you want to say anything critical of this, it's like, why are we wasting our time when the world is perishing? We should be telling them about Jesus. Okay, well, one of the battles we've got is people don't even think the Bible's true or real or reliable, so we can call this apologetic work if you want to. Okay, in Exodus chapter 12, Exodus 12, verse 4. I'm looking for it here in my Bible. All right. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 4. Am I finding it here? I got something wrong here. Can you guys help me out? I made a mistake. Anywhere, I've got to find that. There's a mistake I made. Exodus 12, verse 4. It's in this chapter. What it says is it's going to say that Jacob, from the time Jacob came into Egypt in Genesis, it was 430 years. It's what? Verse 40. Thank you very much. I forgot the zero. Okay, thank you. Oh, that's very humbling right there. When I get it, I don't know what, because it's like, but I panic. It's like maybe it's not in the Bible. Maybe it's like, okay, here it is. Thank you. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut all that out of my video. And it's like Exodus 12 verse 4, or Exodus 12 verse 40. Now the length of time the Israelite people lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, the very day, all the Lord's divisions have left Egypt because the Lord kept vigil for the night. Goes through and talks about that. So they were in there, Israelites, or they came down, not Joseph, but his brothers came down, not just to visit, but they came down with Jacob. And so now you subtract that down. Jacob goes into Egypt in 1876 B.C. Now you see, we're getting close. See right here? We're getting close to this map, right, or a little chart. 1876, Jacob goes to Egypt. Then we go down there. Jacob was 130 years old when he gave birth, or when his first Isaac was born. And you add that onto there, you can figure that out. And now it's 2006. Isaac is born. Isaac was 60 when Jacob was born, so Isaac would be born in 2066. Abraham was 100 when Isaac was born, so he had 100 years of that. That's 2166. It was when Abraham was born. So that's where we're at right here on this chart. 2166, Abraham is born. And so why is that date 2166 here? Because we started in 853. That's pretty solid so far. And then you've got these events taking place, and they're doing excavation work, and we're finding things that are happening in this time period, and history is being written. I mean, this whole time history is being written. In fact, that's how we started. History was written on Estelle. And just keep marching through there. That's Abraham. And just now go to Genesis 11, just so you can see this. Genesis 11. And that's our last chapter on this chart. And Genesis 11 is that category that fits. See, this is Genesis 10. But in Genesis chapter 10, in this big picture, you've got Genesis 11 giving you some details. Part of the details of Genesis 10, he gives you the genealogy generally of Japheth, Ham, and Shem. Just talks about the three sons. But you're going to pick up Shem, the very important son, because he's going to lead to Abraham. And he's going to give you right here from verse 10 to 26, 16 verses of the genealogy from Shem to Abraham in chapter 11. And that's what we have right here. You go to chapter 11 and verse 10. Of chapter 11, verse 10 of Genesis, this is the account of Shem. And as you know, that is the word toledo. This is the written document of Shem, which I would think it's been written down by these guys. They're writing things. They're writing. These things are written during this time period. So there's no reason for this to be campfire stories of people just telling stories and handing down and memorizing. They memorized it. They handed it down. But they also inscribed it. They engraved it. And so Moses may not be writing this from memory. He may not be writing this by just, well, let's see, what's some names of some people? And just making up some kind of a story. Now, some people wanted to say that this was all made up while the Jews were in Babylonian captivity, and they just fabricated a legend that they motivated them. That's so easy to disprove. But that's what they want to believe, that in the Big Bang. Moses probably had documents. Remember, he was trained in all the wisdom of Egypt. So how did Moses know all these things? He spent 40 years being trained by the most educated, technically advanced people of that age of Egypt. And then met God and came back and took him out. Okay. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. And after he became the father of Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arphaxad was 35 years old, he became the father of Shelah. And you can just all the way down until you get to Terah having Abram. And so you just keep taking those numbers and keep adding them up. And so you go from Jacob to Isaac to Abraham. Terah is 2236 B.C. Nahor is 2265 B.C. Sarug is 2295 B.C. Reu is 2359. Peleg, 2389. 2389 is a big deal. I should have put that in highlight. I should have highlighted that. Because in Peleg's day, right here, in Peleg's day, it stops and tells you, right here, the earth was divided. Now, I have taught in the framework book, and I've taught it before, just like I taught the gap theory. I said that the earth was divided. That would have been after the flood. That's about 100 years after the flood that the continental plates broke apart, this continental drift that helped create the mountains. And so it says the earth was divided. It's talking about the continents because it's the earth, the planet, not the world. The Tower of Babel is going to separate the world with language. The earth is divided by continental plates. That may be the case, or it may be that in Peleg's day, the Tower of Babel took place. I mean, that's what the storyline is. The Tower of Babel took place, and then Peleg is born and says, now, it was during his time that the earth was divided. Oh, what division? Well, what we just got to tell you about, the Tower of Babel. So the common sense would be when it says the earth was divided, because just a few verses before, they divided the earth with languages. So that would make sense. There is room, possibly, that we're talking about two events. One, the Tower of Babel, where we separated the people, and then the continental plates being shifted. Now, I think there was some kind of movement of the plates, for sure, when it talks about the flood. When the fountains of the deep burst forth, there would have been some kind of cracking, you know, earthquake and water coming up highly pressured by the continental plates just erupting into the atmosphere and then coming down as frozen ice and snow. Not just water, but freezing and burying things, not just in water, but burying things in ice coming out of the sky. And that would have been the continental plates opening up. So, nonetheless, Peleg, right there in Peleg's day, right within that window, we got the Tower of Babel taking place, either before or right exactly in his time period. Okay, anyway, Peleg, the earth was divided. Then that's, so Tower of Babel right around 2389. Eber, 24, and Eber, that's Hebrew. That's the name for the Hebrews. 2423, 2453, Shelah. Then his father was Arpachshad. It was 2468. And then 2488 is the flood. Again, I can't give you a verse. And, you know, 400 years before that, the flood took place. But we counted back going through those genealogies. The flood is in Noah's 600th year is when the flood takes place. And so that would be 2488. Shem is born about 102 years before the flood. Noah is born in 3088 B.C. Now look at this. I just put this in here. Adam lives 930 years, so if that's his creative creation, he dies in 3211. So he dies right before Noah is born. Or not right before, but he dies before Noah is born. He lives up until Lamech, Methuselah, Enoch. So Adam could have interacted with Enoch, Methuselah, and Noah's father Lamech. Now, if that's the case, how do these people know all this? Well, Adam still, how do they know about the story of the Garden of Eden? Do you think Adam ever told the story? You know, sitting around with all the guys. Well, let me tell you, it was Eve. I mean, but the story had to be told, and especially, you know, the details. Then Lamech, Methuselah, 3457. Interesting, everybody wants to know about Enoch. That would be 3519 B.C. 3519 B.C. is when Enoch is born. Jared, Mahilel, Kenan, Enosh, Seth would be the third child, third son of Adam. That would be 4011. And then Adam is created, because it says he was born, I think it's 130th year. I think it's what it says. You have to do the math there. And then that would figure out creation at 4141 B.C. That is how I get this time chart. And again, feel free to go and work it up yourself. But if you're going to use these numbers, you're going to have to use it. I think I could go back and make some corrections, maybe do a little bit better addition and subtraction. I think I messed up right around Shem. I think I messed up with Shem's son. I think I went the wrong way with he was born 2 years after the flood. And I think I went the wrong way. I think my numbers may be off by two digits. That's one mistake I think I made. Okay, turn the page. And you've got a chart right there from the framework book, the person or event. This is what I put in the framework book. Adam was created 4,000 B.C. Enoch lived about 3,400 B.C. And all the way up to Malachi around 430 B.C. Those are the dates I put in the framework book in 2008. I also put this other chart here. This is interesting. This is from Shem to Isaac and how long they lived. So when Isaac was born, Shem, Noah's son, dies at 500 years old. Abraham was 110, and Isaac was a 10-year-old boy when Shem dies. Shem, who rode the ark, according to the Bible, was alive until Isaac was 10 years old, or was alive until Abraham was 110 years old. And they were writing stuff down. Not only were they writing stuff down, they could talk. They're in the same general area. Now, some people make the case that Shem sounds like that must be Melchizedek. You can play with that idea, but that's not the case. Especially when you talk about the priesthood, because Shem is the ancestor of both Abraham and Levi and Aaron and Jesus. And so Melchizedek has a priesthood that's not even connected to Abraham. It's a Gentile priesthood. If it was Melchizedek, it just doesn't make sense, the writing of Hebrews. Nonetheless, that's worth saying. But again, notice how long they lived. People that saw the Tower of Babel, saw the flood, lived for, you know, the next four generations to tell people about it. And then here is on the very back is just the overlap, kind of a weak chart, but that's the overlap of the lifespans of everybody. So you can see how far, you can take a piece of paper and you see Adam lived up through, and you can see how far everybody lived. Also, interestingly, bottom of page 3, if you take a Methuselah, was born in 3457, 3457. He lives 969 years, and that means he would have died in 2488 B.C. Noah was born in 3088 B.C., and the flood came in his... Oh, I did it again. Shoot. I have to cut this off. What happened there? Did I do something? What did I do wrong? I was really rushing right here. 608 years. Oh, yeah, you subtract. Oh, I was adding. Thank you. I see I'm panicking. Tony's ready to go eat. Camera's over time. All right, I'm subtracting. Oh, not a problem. God, I'm so much smarter than I thought I was. Okay, 2488 B.C. So Methuselah dies the year the flood comes. Now, I don't think he dies in the flood. Methuselah's name means when he dies, it comes. And he was named, as you can see, by his father, Enoch the prophet. And Methuselah lived, was the oldest man, 969, recorded in Scripture. And it was he's a living prophecy. The judgment comes when he dies, and you've got 1,000 years to get ready. And then he dies. It's like, and doesn't say the Bible, but how did Noah when to get on the ark? Well, God told him. How did God tell him? Grandpa's dead. It's like, I don't know if that was how. But anyway, I'll pray, and that's the foundation of what we're working on here. We'll come back and start reading the text next week. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the truth you presented to us. We ask that we would not hold to these dates as if there's some religious specialty, but Father, that it just testifies to the authenticity of your word and the surety of the things you've done in the past, the promises of the future, that these things will take place in our life and in our future. We do thank you for the word of God, for the Spirit, and for fellowship with other believers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.